Well, there are efforts all over the place to try and draw lines between the big boy and the little boys. The big boy being, of course, the Roman Catholic Church, and the little boys being the rest of us. There's no denying the fact that when you have a billion-plus Catholics worldwide, they're the biggest show in town. There was a decision last year by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Now, bear in mind, that's only about 67 million Catholics represented there out of that 1 billion plus. But the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops decided to join an ecumenical group called Christian Churches Together in the USA. We're going to talk about this alliance and what it means that the big boy has joined the club here in the first half hour of Issues, Etc. We're back live this Tuesday afternoon. It is the 26th of April. I'm Todd Wilkin. And the rest of the lineup is going to be very interesting and full as well. In about 25 minutes, Gary Habermas joins us to talk about the historical reliability of the New Testament. Now, to regular listeners, this will sound a lot like, well, I hope it doesn't, but it might sound a lot like conversations we've had before. How do you measure the authenticity and the reliability of the New Testament? Well, there's a lot of manuscript evidence that far outstrips the other ancient writings. That's certainly true. But there are also other ways of measuring the reliability and the authenticity that we haven't talked about. We'll be talking about some of those there in that hour-long conversation with Dr. Gary Habermas of Liberty University. Then at 4:30, we pick up with Kristen Day of Democrats for Life. We'll be talking about a new initiative launched by pro-life Democrats. And then, in the last hour, two guests. Pastor Eric Andre will join us. He's going to be one of the speakers for a conference next week on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis called A Hammer for God. We're going to talk about 20th century Lutheran theologian Bo Yeerts, author of this classic work that I have talked about so many times on the air called The Hammer of God. And then in the last half hour of the program, Dr. Frank Beckwith joins us of Baylor University to do a little post-election analysis of social conservatives. A lot of analysis has been done. A lot of nasty things have been said about the so-called values voter. We'll find out why those nasty things have been said in the last half hour of the program. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Ralph McKenzie is a regular guest here on the program. He is co-author of the book Roman Catholics and Evangelicals, Agreements and Differences, and he's also written a story for the latest Christian research journal titled Catholic Bishops Join Christian Alliance. Pastor McKenzie, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Yes, please just call me Ralph.
Okay, Ralph, how important is it that the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, representatively the largest group of Christians in the U.S. and worldwide, joins this alliance, Christian Churches Together in the USA?
Well, it's important because, first of all, I must tell you that this Christian Churches in the USA is an attempt to, on the part of the National Council of Churches, to reach out and to bring in some evangelicals who have hitherto resisted being part of the National Council of Churches. Now, the fact that the Catholic bishops have signed on indicates that there is a considerable percentage of them are perhaps, one might say, charitably moderates or perhaps left of center, and they are interested in ecumenism the way it used to be defined, which is everybody get together and sing kumbaya and hug and kiss and so forth, regardless of your doctrinal perspectives. But it's yet to be determined which way this is going to go. There are a number of bishops and cardinals who are conservative. Unfortunately, I don't think they're in the majority, but we're going to have to wait and see how this plays out.
What do we know about Christian Churches Together in the USA, apart from the fact that they have been joined by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops?
Well, we know that that they came into being by, as I said earlier, under the direction of the National Council of Churches, and they would include persons who might be identified as evangelicals, such as Ron Sider and Jim Wallace. Jim Wallace is very much in the news these days because the Democrats have seized on him and asked him for advice on how to reach out to to persons of faith, because they were unable to do that during the last election. Hence, I think, contributed greatly to the defeat of John Kerry. And so Jim Wallace, who calls himself an evangelical but is very left of center on many social issues, has come out of the woods and is a part of this new group. He and Ron Sider and others that feel the way they do, and so they are hoping to present a new face for the National Council of Churches, a more evangelical face, if you will.
Now, there are holdouts, of course, to this Alliance of Christians and the Christian Churches Together in the USA. One most notable, of course, in your article in the Christian Research Journal, is the largest Protestant denomination in the USA, 16 million strong, the Southern Baptist Convention. They're still holdouts. Why so?
Yes, and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod did not sign on. Both groups are very, very determined in their conservative theological stances. As a matter of fact, later on in the article where I talk about Catholic response, I quote from two people. One I know that is very familiar to your audience would be Helen Hull Hitchcock.
Yes.
The wife of a good friend of mine, James Hitchcock. And she shows how closely traditional Catholics and evangelicals have become, because she said that when I saw that the Southern Baptists were not involved, and I saw that Wallace and Sider were, that immediately produced the red flags for me, and I knew that something was awry.
You also quote Father Richard John Newhouse, who, ironically, is a former Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod pastor, now a very influential Roman Catholic priest and editor-in-chief of First Things. Hardly need to mention the significance of that publication. What is his thought on the alliance?
Well, Father Newhouse is nothing if not subtle, plays his cards very close to his clerical vest, and says that that we have to wait and see. And he says, of course, that full communion between Catholics and Protestants and others from the Catholic perspective involves a lot more than these sorts of alliances. In point of fact, full communion is involved. But Father Newhouse takes a wait-and-see attitude, and I'm sure that he is not going to get roped into any comments which or pronouncements that would challenge Orthodox Christian thinking, because in spite of what Missouri Synod Lutherans might think about Father Newhouse defecting and swimming the Tiber to Rome, he is a very, very Orthodox a Christian and very perceptive. And the first things is a great publication. Mm-hmm. The most important thing about Father Newhouse is he endorsed our book.
Oh, well, I should also say, second most important thing would be that he's also a regular guest on this program as well.
Oh, well,
valued for
you.
His insights there.
Yes.
Now, here's something, and this is a personal concern of mine with regard to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops joining Christian Churches Together in the USA, this alliance.
Right.
And that is that. And I think evangelicals often do not realize this, that ecumenism with the Roman Church is sometimes, from the Catholic perspective, a one-way street. That is, they're interested in us returning to Rome, and they're very willing to open their arms and their hands to us in that respect. But if they're completely honest, they're not interested in moving our direction on doctrinal issues. Have I mischaracterized it?
I would say it a little differently. I would say that your first point is quite correct, that they wish for everyone to return to Rome. But there have been some interesting discussions and I think some movement amongst participants. I'm thinking in particular was the ECT, Evangelicals and Catholics Together. I have some very good friends that are involved there. One of the chief participants is Timothy George. And now Timothy George is dean of Samford Divinity School, which is he's attached to the Samford University Beeson Divinity School in Birmingham, Alabama. And he's a very, very committed Southern Baptist. He's a wonderful historical theologian and is an editor on the staff of Christianity Today has made a significant impact in this discussion. He's also, I might tell you, a very, very close friend of Avery Cardinal Dulles, who unfortunately is too old to have voted in the conclave for the Pope, but they are very, very close, and there's some interesting discussions coming out, and some clarifications and reexaminations of doctrines and positions that have came up since the Reformation.
Well, speaking of the Pope, most recently elected Benedict XVI made headlines over the weekend by talking about reuniting the church as one of the goals of his tenure.
Yes.
Is this alliance between the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and other churches the kind of thing he might have in mind?
Tangentially, perhaps, but Benedict XVI is a very, very careful historical theologian. In point of fact, while the last Pope, John Paul II, was primarily a philosopher, and the two of them were very, very close friends, Benedict XVI is more of a theologian, and he understands the differences that we would make between a liberal, a mainline Protestantism and evangelicalism. Secondly, the main concern, certainly of the last Pope, was to first reunite the Eastern Orthodox churches, or church, if you will. He used to say the church must learn to breathe with both of its lungs. Unfortunately, that didn't happen in his lifetime. But that's their first concern, is to unite the East and the Eastern Orthodox churches with Roman Catholicism, which, from a Roman perspective, they are almost there. All the resistance in that particular maneuver comes from the Orthodox side of the house.
We're talking about a decision recently by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops to join an ecumenical group called Christian Churches Together in the USA. Our guest, Pastor Ralph McKenzie. In about 10 minutes here, we're going to be talking with Dr. Gary Habermas of Liberty University about the historical reliability of the New Testament. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Ralph, let's talk about the specific doctrinal concerns that have been raised now that this alliance has been joined by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Where would you begin?
Well, they... What they do is they make a. I'm trying to look in the article here where they make a statement about what's important, but many people who are very close to this from the conservative side have said that there's a lot more latitude in the theological statements. For instance, talking about the Bible as the Word of God, that can be generalized and certainly doesn't. Doesn't have the punch that what evangelicals would say, what Orthodox Christians, lowercase o, would say about the Bible being inerrant. And so that's one area where the National Council of Churches will never speak about the Bible being inerrant, what the Bible says, God says. They would say that the Bible is authoritative and is a guideline. But that would be probably the crucial basic difference of approach. And they're hoping, the National Council is hoping that this language and this terminology sounds sounds a little bit better to people, and that they will get on board. And in the Catholic community, you also have those that the traditional Catholic position, interestingly enough, is pretty much the one that we would hold to as evangelical Christians, that the Bible is inerrant, and what it, the Bible says, God says. And so in the Council of Bishops, since they have been for the last 50 or some years impacted by liberal Protestant higher criticism, both Bultmannianism and the like, you have some people that aren't quite that don't quite hold the line with us. But then you have others, such as, for instance, Bishop Brakowitz from Nebraska, and others, Cardinal George from Chicago is very, very Orthodox. So it's a mixed bag, you know. It's the Catholic bishops are like the little girl from England. When she's good, she's very good indeed. And when she's bad, she's not so good, you know. And yet you
quote Thomas Oden of Drew University saying, quote, in reference to the this alliance we're talking about, this is not the post-National Council of Churches, post-World Council of Churches, new ecumenism for which many traditional believers have hoped. It is a restatement of the old ecumenism, he cautioned. What is Oden saying here about this alliance that should at least raise a red flag?
Well, he's saying what I've been implying, I think. And by the way, Thomas Oden has a wonderful conversion story. He was had been very, very liberal at Drew University. Well, he's still attached to Drew, but he's anathema to his liberal colleagues there, because he came to a position where he realized that the liberation theology and all these other liberal positions were counter to Orthodox Christianity, and had a wonderful conversion experience of that sort. And he is saying the same thing. He is saying this is just old-time liberalism, just polished up a little bit and using some different terminology. And I think he's exactly right.
Do you, someone would raise the concerns that Roman Catholics are using agreements with Lutherans and Protestants on social issues, the general social issues, and perhaps even the general doctrinal issues, to proselytize people back to Roman Catholicism? How would you respond to that?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to generalize, because there are all sorts of different movements going on, and it's also different really to know what people are holding in their heart of hearts. I think it's our responsibility to read what is written, to listen to what people say, and to comment on it, and to compare it to biblical truth and Orthodox theology as we know it. Of course, I wrote an article on this for the Christian Research Institute Journal. Two authors write about the doctrine on justification doctrine on justification, where the World Lutheran organization and the Vatican got together and came to some things where they agreed on. Now, evangelicals have been very critical of that. But my response is, well, we should have gotten involved with it ourselves. You know, there is no evangelical participation in these discussions on that level, and certainly on that declaration. But I suppose that some of them would use that, and of course the World Council of Lutherans is not an organization that the Missouri Synod's involved with.
No.
And so these would be Lutheran mainliners, and again, the little girl from England analogy comes into play here as well.
Then finally, Ralph, how representative is this alliance of, in two respects? One, the Conference of Catholic Bishops, I've been reminded many times, is not necessarily representative of Roman Catholicism in any sense. And two, how representative is the alliance of the American Church in general? You got about a minute and a half here.
You're asking me about the new organization, this Association of Christian Churches?
Yeah, how representative is it of the American Church?
The American Church meaning the American Protestant Church?
Well, American Christendom, I guess I should say.
Well, it falls down, you know. Their big thrust is we need to take the gospel to the poor. The social issues, a redistribution of wealth, and so forth, which are issues where there are differences of opinion. We can take a democratic view, a democratic view meaning that the Democratic Party view versus the Republican Party on some of these issues, but where it definitely causes a problem is when they talk about the moral issues. They seem to come down on the left of center views. For instance, if not abortion on demand, abortion in most cases, the blessing of homosexual unions, all the way to the permission of homosexual marriage, and so forth. So I don't think it's representative of conservative Christians, evangelical Christians, and certainly the election showed that to be true. This was the first election where a majority of Catholics voted for a Republican candidate, which is very, very unusual historically. And so we're getting a place at the table, and that's something to thank God for. We're getting a place at the table. Look at Time Magazine and the 25 most prominent evangelical leaders in the United States.
About 20 seconds here.
Even though they had a few ringers in that group, it's something to celebrate, but we should keep our eyes and ears open and pray that the Holy Spirit would continue to lead the church and build up the body of Christ.
Pastor Ralph McKenzie, thank you for being our guest.
It's always nice to be on your program.
Pastor Ralph McKenzie is co-author of the book Roman Catholics and Evangelicals, Agreements and Differences. He's also written a story for the latest Christian Research Journal titled Catholic Bishops Join Christian Alliance. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time talking with Dr. Gary Habermas. The usual way of building a case for the authenticity and reliability of the New Testament, we have done many times here on Issues, etc., and that is, let's look at the manuscript evidence and the preponderance of this evidence, especially when it is compared with other ancient documents. Well, there are other ways of also affirming the authenticity and reliability of the New Testament, and we'll explore some of those with Dr. Gary Habermas when we come back from this break. He is from Liberty University. We'll be talking with him. And then, after that hour-long conversation, Kristen Day of Democrats for Life joins us to talk about a new initiative of pro-life Democrats.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
You might be tempted to think that the basic teachings of the Christian faith, the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, Scripture's teaching on baptism, absolution, and the Lord's Supper, are the kind of things that you learn when you're a new Christian. But as you mature, you go on to bigger and better things. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, The Lord Will Answer, a daily prayer catechism, grounds you in the essentials of the Christian faith in your daily devotions. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, and order the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, The Lord Will Answer. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Right there on our homepage, you'll find information on the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April. The Lord Will Answer.
Teachers to missionary kids have a crucial role to play in missions. This Global Minute wants you to pray for more qualified teachers to invest their time worldwide. A good teacher in a missions boarding school or local school setting will get the attention of students while parents are working directly in Bible translation, church planting, a health clinic, or doing other activities. A good teacher will also be someone who disciples the students and empathizes with them while praying for them to draw close to Christ. Not that much different from teaching in the States. And the need for missionary teachers is real. Contact a mission agency of your choice and ask if they need teachers. Pray more Christians will use their teaching skills with missionary families and in MK schools. Seeing a world of opportunities to serve is only a click away at the website missionvisionnetwork.org. missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Does God bring bad things into our lives? Some Bible passages say yes. Is there evil in the city and the Lord has not done it? Asks the prophet Amos. 2 years ago, I had been invited to preach for the 50th anniversary of the Lutheran Church of the Good Shepherd in Greenville, South Carolina. Just before that anniversary, the church burned down. Despite the total destruction of their sanctuary, the people decided to celebrate their anniversary anyway. Keep on keeping on. Last Sunday, I was back in Greenville, this time to preach for the dedication of their brand new church building. In all the happy words of the weekend, several people said, "God burned our church down." Maybe so. Years after Joseph had been sold into slavery by his brothers, Joseph said, "You thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good, to save many people alive." Keep on keeping on isn't easy, but somewhere along the way you want to experience a shift. To "this is bad," you add, "this is also for good." Yogi Berra said, "When you come to a fork in the road, take it. It's not either or. God's mercy enables you to take both ways. This is bad, and God's blessing us through it."
Our on-air three-day event we call Share-a-thon is over for another year, but that doesn't mean that you missed your opportunity to pledge support to AM 850KFUO. If you didn't pledge during Share-a-thon 2005 but would still like to make a gift, call me, Chuck Rathert, at 505-7831. And I will personally see to it that your gift is included in our Share-a-thon total. Or use the gift option on our website at kfuo.org. Thanks in advance for thinking of us at AM 850KFUO. 505-7831.
Christians, of course, believe that the Bible in general and the New Testament in particular are reliable documents. These assembled books, the Gospels, the Epistles, these are reliable. That their historicity is beyond question. Now, why do we believe that? Of course, we believe it because Jesus Christ authenticates Scripture ultimately. We do not believe in Jesus because He's in the Bible. We believe that the Bible is true because Jesus is revealed therein. So with that said, are there cases, is there a case that can be made for the authenticity and reliability of the New Testament? Now, many times here on Issues, etc., we have discussed the kind of the classic case that is made, and that is assembling the manuscript evidence, which, if piled up, piles much higher than any other ancient document. Are there other ways of making the case for the authenticity and recognizing the reliability of the Gospel accounts and the New Testament? We're going to be talking about that in this hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilk, and Dr. Gary Habermas joins us to discuss that subject. Now, as we talk with Dr. Habermas about the historical reliability of the New Testament, the best callers and emailer will receive, in this next hour, will receive Dr. Habermas's book, Resurrected, which is, by the way, the account of a debate between Dr. Habermas and someone he has worked with and was recently in the news regarding, and that is an atheist philosopher, once atheist philosopher, Anthony Flew. We're going to be talking with him about that in just a moment as we kick off our conversation. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc at kfuo.org. Dr. Gary Habermas is a regular guest here on the program. He is a distinguished professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University. He's authored several books, including The Risen Jesus and Future Hope, and the book I just mentioned, going to our best caller and emailer, Resurrected. Dr. Habermas has also written an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Recent Perspectives on the Reliability of the Gospels. Dr. Habermas, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd. Good to talk to you again.
Now, let's talk about atheist or once atheist philosopher Antony Flew for a moment. Beyond being the part of the subject of your book Resurrected, you worked with him in what some have called a recent conversion. Tell us about it.
Well, going back a little bit, Tony and I have been good friends for, actually this spring, it's 20 years. And we met in Dallas, Texas in early 2005 is now, obviously, early 1985. And there are a bunch of debates going on at Dallas. And a few months later, he came to Liberty University and he and I debated our first time in the resurrection. Well, to make a long story and a long friendship short, he and I have dialogued in the resurrection three total times, and that book you're talking about is Resurrected, is the substance of our second debate. And after that second debate, he wrote me a rather long and interesting letter and sounded like something was happening in him. And so he and I, you know, we've been corresponding for 20 years. We kept talking back and forth, and we dialogued again in 2003, and it seemed like he was kind of warring within himself over a number of these issues from at least 2000 on, for at least these 4 years until early 2004. And one time when I was talking to him, he said, "I've become a theist." And I said, "You know, really?" And he said, "Yeah, I think I'm." And he said, "You know, not the kind that believes in a book, not the kind that believes in revelation, but I do believe in God." And so I ended up interviewing him in early 2004, and he and I tinkered with this interview for more than a year, all of 2004, and it was just published like 2 weeks ago in Philosophia Christi. And at least manuscript-wise, it was about 27 pages. He about doubled it after we worked on it. But he clearly came to belief in God, and he said what really led him there were the arguments of Aristotle, the philosophic arguments for God, and also he's been impressed with some intelligent design arguments.
Now, let's be careful to point out that he has gone from being an atheist to a theist. What exactly does that mean? This falls far short of, say, former atheist philosopher now becomes believing Christian.
Right. He definitely isn't a Christian. He does not believe in the God of any revelation. That's the way he says it. And he thinks that there's evidence for God, and most likely that God's behind the creation and that sort of thing, but not that he sent or wrote any particular book. Now, he does seem to say clearly in our interview that he thinks Christianity is the best attested of the religions. In fact, he makes some amazing comments about the resurrection. He says he doesn't believe it, but he thinks that there's more evidence for the resurrection than there is for any other miracle claim in the world of religions. He says that Jesus is an extremely charismatic figure, easy to believe in him. I heard him say on another occasion that Jesus is a great moral philosopher, Paul, a great philosopher, the Bible is a wonderful book, well worth reading, not so the books in other religions. I mean, that's him talking. So he said a lot of these things, but he does not believe in the God of any particular revelation. So when he and I are together, I'll just say, "I'm praying for you, Tony. You know, you still got some while to come around." He'll say, "Well, I don't know. I'm 81 years old. You know, I don't know how much, you know, what's out there." And I even ask him at the end of the interview, "Do you think there's much chance you'll come to Christianity?" And other people have asked him that too, and he'll say, "Well, I don't think so, but I won't rule it out." So that's about where we are. I think probably deism is the best expression of his system, the belief that God exists but doesn't intervene in our affairs. Deism may be the more proper of the two terms, but in our interview, we actually went with the word theism. The title is called My Pilgrimage from Atheism to Theism. And if I recall the conversation from the early 04, he said he wanted to use the word theism because so few people understood the definition of deism. But when he describes it, that's where he comes out.
Well, you had just mentioned Antony Flew's concession that the resurrection is the best attested miracle account in all of religious writings. That segues nicely into our conversation for this hour, Dr. Habermas, and that is the historical reliability of the New Testament and the gospel accounts in general. How is that case classically made by Bible scholars for the historicity of the Gospels?
Right. Well, I think as you set it up at the beginning of the your broadcast here, the way it is generally introduced is something like this. I think most Christian apologists will argue that the New Testament text is reliable. Some will even dare. I say dare because the case is harder to make. They will argue that the New Testament is inspired. And from this reliable and or inspired text, there's this event in this book, and it's the center of this book, and it's called The Resurrection. And as a reliable book, we can trust what it says. And therefore, look what it says. This is the best case we have for a miracle. Other naturalistic theories don't line up, and so on and so on. But they use the main point is on the traditional case, they use or argue toward, let's say, a reliable New Testament, which they didn't take and say that the best case for this is that Jesus was raised from the dead. So they have to do something with the text, and they'll, you know, start by arguing that the text makes sense, that it's well attested in historical and archaeological terms, just like you said at the outset.
Now, there is a preponderance of manuscript evidence, and that certainly is a strong case to be made as well. Yet you have written recently that some very strong arguments for the reliability of the gospel accounts come actually from the thinking of critical scholars, people who are not necessarily
right
on board with the historicity of the whole New Testament. Tell
right
us about those.
In my entire apologetic enterprise, I won't say I never argue from what I call top-down approaches. I have the top-down approach being this book is reliable, and in this reliable book we have doctrines X, Y, Z, so let's take them seriously. Let's call that a top-down approach. I call it, sometimes I call it an umbrella approach, that has this, like an umbrella, it has this basis up over our heads, and then it funnels down beneath, protecting everything underneath it. So if the Bible is reliable, everything in it's true. But I would actually prefer and write much more frequently of what I might call a bottom-up approach that says, I'll tell you what, I don't need this book to be inspired to make my point, although I think it is, and I'll say that in debates. Or secondly, I don't need this book to be reliable to make my point, although I think it is. I would rather argue on a case-by-case basis the way more radical critics do, not concede or ask the person to concede reliability, not ask them to concede inspiration, but argue on a case-by-case basis where the idea is I will only use texts that have two characteristics. A, they are well attested, oftentimes multiply so for more than one reason, well attested by our normal means of arguing for a text, whether it's Homer or Plato or Tacitus or something else, where we have evidence for that text, that particular text, not the top-down, all the texts, but the bottom-up, one or two or three or ten key texts. And secondly, I will argue that a good number, if not the vast majority, of critical scholars will concede that this verse is attesting to something that is demonstrable in historical terms. And that's what I call a minimal facts method, and that's the method that I pursue in this article that you mentioned.
Okay, and that kind of, before we go on, I said at the outset, and speaking for myself, and I don't know if I speak for you or not, Dr. Habermas, but that ultimately, when we talk about the authenticity of the New Testament and then generally of all Scripture, for me, it is Christ himself who authenticates the book rather than the other way around. You know, the top-down argument is, well, if the Bible is true, Jesus, then believe in Jesus. I would say, well, let's look at Jesus first and let him authenticate the entire rest of the document. If what he says of himself is true and if he authenticates the document, then it can be believed.
Okay, to know if I agree with you or not, eventually I will, because I will get there. But what I would start with, if I were being the critic, I would ask you, if you're going to start by teachings of Jesus and how he authenticates himself or some other topic, how can I trust those things that he says about himself?
Right, and that's precisely, that's why you're the one who does the debates.
Oh, okay. All right, but see, I mean, I would expect you to say, because again, at the beginning of the show, you said, you know, we've talked many times in this program about ways to evidence reliability. You might come back and say, well, I think this is a generally reliable text. And I'll say, aha, that's the problem. You have a generally reliable text. How do I know that this generally reliable text is reliable in the specific cases that I need to make this argument? And you say, well, because it's generally reliable. And I say, well, that's good. But the libraries, I say in this article, libraries are full of generally reliable books that we don't hesitate to say are wrong on certain occasions. I mean, to give a key example, Christians could say, hey, here's a great science book if you ignore everything in there about evolution. You know, we'll say things like that. Just because something is a good text doesn't mean we buy everything that's between the covers. And critics will make the same move with the New Testament. They'll say, generally reliable? Well, who knows? But I don't know how I'm going to get to these certain cases. So I use the other way around because I think I can get my hands on these specific cases a lot easier.
Well, let's talk about some of those here in the course of our conversation. I invite our listeners to join in as well. 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Best caller, best emailer during this hour with Dr. Gary Habermas will receive his latest book, Resurrected. 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Okay, let's talk about a specific then. Give us an example and how you would go about what you call the bottom-up approach.
Okay. Any example at all?
Sure. One that you think is best representative of how the approach works.
Okay. Well, what I do in this article is I do both. The editor said, hey, look, you're going to lose some of our people, so give a traditional case before you do the other one. So in this article in Christian Research Journal, I give a traditional case, and I'll do what you'll say there, and I'll build a reliability. I will point out to your readers, when you mention things like manuscript evidence and things like that, manuscript evidence, although it's, virtually nobody questions the strength of the manuscript evidence of the New Testament. I mean, Helmut Kester, who's a pretty radical left-wing critic, New Testament scholar, he concedes that the New Testament is an extremely well-evidenced book. What evidence in terms of manuscript numbers? But what manuscript tells us is that we have essentially what the original author wrote. Now, it's a separate step in the traditional apologetic. It's a separate step to say, okay, so we have what Matthew wrote. Now we need to know is if what Matthew said is reliable. And those are two separate steps. We can know what Matthew said, and then Matthew could end up being wrong. So we want to know both what Matthew said and that Matthew's right. Those are the two steps you have to take in a traditional approach. On my approach, I would go into Matthew and I would take a particular text or any of the Gospels, but it works best in Matthew, Mark, and Luke because those are the ones that the critics are mostly going to deal with. And I would take a text. I'll give you an example. How do we know who Jesus said he was? You said a moment ago, you know, we might want to talk about the subject. What does Jesus say about himself? Is he attested from his own teaching? I would say we have the best hints of who Jesus said he was from the two titles, Son of God and Son of Man. You say, well, how in the world do you get the Son of God and Son of Man if you don't take this umbrella reliability approach? Because I would take one title or the other. For example, let's take Son of Man. And I would argue that I can trust the Son of Man title as used by Jesus by several reasons that critics would allow. For example, I would say using two of their best tests, critics will divide the Gospels into five sources. That's at least typical. Do you want me to give these five sources? Will that be?
Yeah, please do. I mean, it's you know, bearing in mind that we can only take so much at some time, but yes, please do.
Okay, it will be brief. I just don't want to have people just scratching their head and going, where in the world is he going? But here's the way a critic would dissect the five Gospels, unless I say a critic, like there's only one way. This is a typical way of dissecting the Gospels. They will say, okay, we have the book of Mark, and this is, again, the critic speaking. Mark's the earliest Gospel, so what Mark says is on one level, that's his book, earliest gospel, that's a major source. Okay, then we have the Gospel of John. They'll say that's the opposite. That's the latest source, and John has less interaction with the other three than they have with each other, so John is another source. That's two sources. Now, the way the critics think, Matthew and Luke make the most use of Mark. But where they don't use Mark, they use other material. The stuff that's in Matthew that's nowhere else, we'll simply call M, and the stuff that's in Luke that's nowhere else, we'll simply call L. So far you got M, which means Matthew alone, L, which is Luke alone, Mark, and if it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as long as it's in Mark, it's called Mark, and John, that's four. Then they've got this source that some say is very illusory, the so-called Q sayings of Jesus. And without debating what Q is, let's just identify Q as sayings that Matthew and Luke have in common that we do not find in Mark. It's that common. And we have five there. Now, once again, that's M, Matthew alone, L, Luke alone, Mark, the whole book of Mark, the whole book of John, and this Q, which is Matthew and Luke, which is not in Mark. That's five sources. Now, when I say Son of Man, your readers, your listeners would be real interested, I would think, to note that Son of Man sayings of Jesus are in all five of these strata. They're in all five sources. Critics think that the most evidential sources are Mark and Q. Mark and Q. And Jesus clearly calls himself the Son of Man in Mark and Q. That's one way to get the Son of Man. Another way is a test that many critics think is the toughest of all the tests and the one that yields the narrowest but the best results is called discontinuity. And basically, discontinuity is, could this teaching be laid at the feet of Jews at the time of Jesus or in the early church? Maybe even though it's Jesus said, you know, in the gospel, Jesus said such and such, or red letter words, could this be a common Jewish teaching or a common church teaching? And the answer on Son of Man is definitely not. Whereas Jews have a teaching of Son of Man, while they clearly have Son of Man teachings, they would never call Jesus the Son of Man. And secondly, while the early church, you would think, well, that's easy, he's Son of Man, the epistles never call Jesus the Son of Man a single time. So I know this is a lengthy discussion, but that's two ways to know that we've got something here on certain select texts where Jesus is called the Son of Man.
So essentially, what you are laying before us is critical scholars look at the Bible, look at the New Testament in this way, especially the Gospels, and you are saying, all right, how can I engage the critical scholars' own criteria, use them, and still be able to demonstrate in this bottom-up approach, using the specifics of the text rather than the umbrella approach, how can I demonstrate that certain aspects of this are reliable using the critics, conceding the critics' own,
right,
for the sake of argument, their own,
right,
criteria?
That's a very important point, Todd. I am saying, because I will tell the critic up front, I believe in inspiration, or I believe in reliability, but for your sake, for the sake of this discussion, I will not use my principles, I will use your principles to get to the conclusion that I want to get to. It's what I might call a heads I win, tails you lose argument. If the Bible's inspired, resurrection happened, Christianity's true. If the Bible is only, quote-unquote, reliable, then Christianity's true, and the resurrection happened, Christianity follows. And by the way, I'll say on either one of those views, inspiration will be the next step. You can show that the Bible is most likely inspired because the resurrected Jesus said so and God wouldn't raise a heretic and so on. That's where I would get to the point you raised earlier. But if the guy says, well, I'm not going to grant you inspiration or reliability, and they usually don't, not in the sense that evangelicals mean that, I will use their arguments, get to the point that I want to get to, and ask them, what are they going to do now?
We're talking with Dr. Gary Habermas, Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University. He has authored several books, including The Risen Jesus and Future Hope and Resurrected. That book is going to our best caller or emailer during this hour, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or the email address issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Habermas has also written an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Recent Perspectives on the Reliability of the Gospels. So as we go into this break with about a minute and a half here, can you give us one, or at least tease one more specific, and how you would go about, from the specifics, arguing for the general reliability?
Sure. Critics employ a list of rules, and I've already used two of them. One is called multiple attestation. Use as many of these five sources as you can. Don't use two verses in Mark, but uses, I mean, that's okay, but we want to get as many sources as possible. Another one is this discontinuity thing. Well, in this article, I give a number of rules like that. And let me use Son of God, the other name, and use a couple more rules. When Jesus says in Matthew 11:27, and it's Luke in parallel, when Jesus says that he, talking about himself, he says, he talks about his relationship with his Father, he talks about the Father, and he claims to have a unique relationship with the Father. The Father knows me, only I know the Father. Nobody else knows the Father unless I reveal them to the Father. He is claiming to have a unique relationship with the Father, i.e., nobody else has this unless I lead them to it. And that is in Matthew and Luke, not in Mark. So that's called Q. On the critic's supposition, Q is very likely the earliest statements we have of Jesus. So if it's early, and we have it in, you know, Matthew and Luke, that's what makes it Q, that's an indication that he may have believed this very radical thing about himself being a unique position with the Father, i.e., he's the Son, and, you know, he's in a unique position with the Father. That's one. But in Mark 13:32, I'll go to another source now, Mark, Jesus says, talking about himself, and talking about his return, that day or hour knows no man, not the angels, not even the Son. And that is a principle called embarrassment. And the point is, if the text is going to say something embarrassing about Jesus, i.e., how can you be the Son of God and not even know when you're coming, there's got to be a reason for saying something embarrassing. And in this text where he's calling himself the Son, he says he doesn't know why, he doesn't know when he's returning. So those are two other tests on Son of God type verses, the Q statement in Matthew and the embarrassment statement in Mark 13:32. Critics will look at those real seriously because they meet their criteria.
When we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Gary Habermas about the historical reliability of the New Testament. We'll talk about some of these other criteria that critical scholars use and how, conceding for the sake of argument that their criteria are valid, from the specifics of the test, they still pass the test. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. I have a question on the other side of the break about what I think of as not just critical scholarship, but hypercritical scholarship. And when all the tests are done, what about the event of the resurrection? Dr. Gary Habermas is our guest. 1-800-730-2727 is our call-in number and our in-studio email address. For questions and comments, we'll take them after this break as well. issuesetc@kfuo.org. The best caller, the best emailer, will receive a copy of Dr. Habermas' book, Resurrected, a debate between Dr. Habermas and, at one time, atheist philosopher Antony Flew. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.